Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the global refugee crisis has reached epic proportions, with millions of people being forced from their homes. We'll explore what can be done. But first, with climate change upon us, the Earth is changing the way it functions. What exactly is occurring and where are we headed? Scientists say the Earth is changing more rapidly than we have expected. Ecosystems are shifting and some species are dying out. What does this mean for humanity? Larry Schweiger is with us. Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Welcome, Larry Schweiger.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. So your book, Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth, was 5 years ago. Since then, we've had a lot of science. I think you said something like 37% of species would be extinct by 2050.
50.
Is that still happening?
We're still on course for continued extinctions. In fact, the latest I've seen is 40 to 70% of the species, according to the path that we're currently on.
By 2050?
Well, it's by the end of the century, they'll be on the road to extinction, is the way I characterize it in the book. And that pattern is continuing. And because we're adding more carbon to the atmosphere today than we were then, almost nearly double what we're putting in the air, the speed of this is picking up, and that's has everybody alarmed. Instead of reducing carbon emissions, we're increasing carbon emissions.
Now, one of the things that struck me was that the IPCC said that even though our economics were in decline, that the carbon has, what, doubled since 2000?
Because of what's happening, particularly in China, China has just blown right by the United States in terms of carbon emissions. But we all need to remember that they're making products for us. Our industry has unfortunately moved to China, and they are making manufacturing products largely for America and for South America and elsewhere. But we're the largest customer that they have. You know, we're still contributing to that problem.
So let's talk about that then a little bit. I know that part of the problem with China is coal. Mm-hmm. And I know we have something like 1,000 coal plants that are on track to be built now. I mean, that's like what's coming, the new coal plants. A lot of those are in China.
Yeah, it's really sad that we're continuing to build coal plants anywhere in the world. It doesn't make sense. The World Bank finally has decided it's not going to be funding coal plants anymore. But it's not a prudent investment. We're making these investments. They're going to be around for 30 to 50 years, and they're going to be polluting at a very, very high level. The Earth just simply cannot afford to have that kind of carbon pollution.
Now, you say it's not a good investment. Of course, it's not a good investment environmentally, but it's cheap. Isn't that why you see them going up in the countries such as India and China?
I also think it's bad economic investment because the world is heading to a very disrupted climate. And as that becomes increasingly painful and more clear, they're going to have to wean themselves off of those dirty coal plants. And in my view, the best thing we should be doing right now is investing in wind, solar, efficiency, and a lot of other renewable energy technologies to get us off of this dependence on dirty fuels.
I would like to get into some of that. And I know that there has been quite a bit of movement in some of the cities, like Los Angeles is really getting more and more involved in solar. But let's go back to your book, because you've broken this down in a way that's kind of interesting. There's one chapter where you say victims, perpetrators, and enablers. So let's talk about, first of all, one of the perpetrators you said was really these invasive species, which are getting worse because of climate change. Can you help us understand where it's happening and what are these invasive species and how is it connected to climate?
Well, first of all, when you change the climate, you alter the ecosystems. You can't save an ecosystem unless you save the sky over the ecosystem. So as these systems warm up and change, dry out, other species begin to move in as the original species disappear. And we're seeing that pattern. Rivers, for example, are overheating. So we're losing our cold water fisheries. They're being replaced with warm water fisheries. And in some cases, with invasive species from other continents that are finding their way into these habitats. So endangered species, threatened species, and invasive species all are altered by the changing climate. And unfortunately for the endangered species, it's most often that they disappear.
Can you give us some other examples of ecosystems in which there would be an endangered species that's being threatened by an invasive one?
The one that comes quickly to mind is what's happening to our oceans. We're acidifying our oceans. And so if you're a shellfish or a finfish or phytoplankton, for that matter, you need to use calcium in order to thrive, in order to prosper. And so as these systems are being altered with acidic waters, coral reefs, for example, are in decline in a number of places because of high temperatures as well as high acidity. So that's an example of an entire ocean system that's being stressed.
And the coral reefs, of course, that's a bit of a double whammy because they're like forests. They're supposedly like the lungs of the ocean.
Exactly.
So then it makes the climate worse.
And on the terrestrial side, what's happening to moose is really a good indicator. Moose are disappearing from places like New Hampshire and parts of Maine and New England. And also they've collapsed in Minnesota. The Minnesota moose population has dropped 60% because moose are a cold weather species. And as insects move in, particularly ticks, it takes a big toll on the moose. And we've seen those declines on the southern border of the moose populations.
I think it was also in the IPCC report talking about how so many animals that are cold water animals and other species are moving more and more to the north. But then there are some that really just don't have anywhere to go.
Exactly. That's true on mountains, too. The species that live in high mountain systems are being pushed further and further up the mountain and eventually will not have a place to go. You know, interestingly, Rachel Carson back in 1950 detailed the changing patterns of wildlife and plants and fisheries and birds. She saw climate change because she saw wildlife moving further north and further south on the planet and also further in the oceans further north. So wildlife have been a great indicator of climate change for a long time. We just haven't been listening to them.
That was back in 1950. That's right. I had today's article in The Guardian, I believe it was, talking about just things like butterflies that would normally be common in somewhere like Britain, gone from there and moved onward. And then the animals like the polar bears. Mm-hmm. You've talked about them in the book. They're not the only ones, of course, mm-hmm. that need the Arctic ice to survive.
Well, I visited Churchill last winter and saw the bears. And bears are losing weight year by year because there's not enough ice for them to get out and feed. So they delay their access to the ice, which is where they really get their food. And they scratch around for food on shore, but they don't get very much. And they really need the ice.
How thin is the ice now? I mean, is it just all but disappeared?
The ice has contracted quite substantially. There's great graphs that show that. Last year, it bounced back a little bit, and everybody got all excited about it. But it's truly on a downward path. And there's one study that suggested we have an 80% chance of being ice-free in the Arctic by 2030. We just watch it year by year, and you can see it shrinking away. And that's incidentally altering the weather patterns. You know, this polar vortex that we've experienced in the east, it's made it colder. Here in California, it's made it drier. But clearly, we're in a pattern that is not typical because the Arctic ice is rapidly disappearing.
The droughts are also changing ecosystems considerably, and you're seeing a lot of wildlife moving closer and closer to the cities.
Exactly. I think one of the most troubling trends is the number of very large forest fires. The number of large forest fires in the West has doubled in the last decade. And the Forest Service is predicting yet another doubling of the forest fires. Last year, they spent half of their entire budget fighting forest fires. So here's an agency charged with managing the forest, and they're spending half of their money just simply fighting fires. And of course, we lost 19 firemen, forest firefighters last year in Arizona. So these fires are hotter. And the other important thing about them is that they're burning the soil up. They're so hot that the soil, the humus in the soil gets burnt out. And therefore, it's very, very hard to recover those forests once they've burnt that hot.
When the soil burns, then all of the...
All the seeds are gone. All the organic matter is gone. So you have mineral
soil. So all the life that was in the soil is killed.
And that's what happens when you have these super fires like that. And that's what we're seeing more of.
And then the animals, of course, come into the city. Like we had our famous bear here. I don't know if you followed our bear, Glenn Berrien. Is that happening in other cities as well with these animals moving in increasingly?
Wildlife are opportunists. And if they lose their original habitat, they're going to go searching for other habitats. And we're seeing that. I don't know the particular story of this bear. I heard about it, but I don't know what drove him to the city. But You know, young males will often move into a city as they're looking for some new territory. In the bear population, they tend to be the roamer.
Climate change is bringing about invasive species. What else?
On the good side, people are starting to understand that the system is more fragile. I think there's a growing understanding that our weather patterns are out of whack and that we've seen increasing storms. So I'm hopeful, personally, that we're going to see some political change. I think it's short term. It's looking ugly in Washington because the attitudes, particularly the Republican House members, is to do nothing. And I think that's going to catch up to them. They're on the wrong side of history. So I'm trying to hang on to hope on that. And I think that there's a growing number of businesses that see the need to put a price on carbon and to start shifting the energy production towards a clean energy source.
Do we see more of an industry coming up with the clean energy sources that we were talking about earlier, wind, solar?
Absolutely. I spoke at a forum in San Francisco at Oakland, and a young man came up to me. He's a student there, but he's starting a company to retrofit buildings with efficient light systems. And, you know, he and his buddies have about 30 employees now, and he's a college student. So I think there's a lot of really cool innovation going on, and certainly there's a number of companies that are doing well. I think Tesla has done extraordinarily well, has surpassed most people's understandings. Solar City, First Solar, the wind industry itself has done extraordinarily well. They have unfortunately banged into a limit on their tax program that we have to accelerate the investment in wind, but we're hoping that we'll get that restored this year and more importantly, get a price on carbon.
So let's talk about a couple of these. You mentioned Tesla. I assume most people know about Tesla, but for those who don't, this is an electric car that has been named the best car. It's the safest. It's the best running car.
I think if you look at the founder of Tesla, Elon Musk, he is a person who throughout his life has said, I'm going to do that. And he's been involved in the development of SpaceX, which is now delivering cargo to the space shuttle, to the, and replacing the space shuttle, I should say. Elon is a can-do person. He's currently building a factory for batteries to make batteries for the automobiles and
the electric cars.
And if you ride in a Tesla, as I have, they're just a magnificent car. I mean, the idea of having electric cars is that the motors on electric cars are very clean. They last a long time. They have high acceleration, tremendous control. They give you a fantastic ride. And he's proven that you can take them long distances, and that with the charging stations they're establishing all over the country, it's going to be a transformative technology. It's going to change the way we think about cars. They're clean. They can be driven on wind and solar. I mean, think about that. We can drive cars by using wind and solar.
He's also been involved with Solar City, right?
Yes.
So, which enables people to put solar on their house.
Exactly.
And then they can charge their cars through their house,
right,
all on solar.
Right. So it makes it an inexpensive recharge, and I think it's a fantastic way to go, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that. As he builds more cars, certainly the prices will continue to come down.
I don't know if you're watching this or not, but are you seeing Tesla having an effect on the rest of the car industry?
Oh, I was talking to an engineer at General Motors, and he said, well, you know, we've been working on an internal combustion engine since the last century, he said, and we have an internal combustion engine that's barely 30% efficient. Electric motors start out at 90% efficient. He said, so I guess we can assume that the industry is going to be moving to electric. I think that's happening.
Do you think even the hybrids are going to fade away?
I think hybrids are going to get more sophisticated, but ultimately will break into electric cars.
Do you know if the Teslas have gone into other countries as well, or are they just mostly focused in the U.S.?
No, they're actually building a plant in one of the Norwegian countries. I'm not sure exactly where, but they're definitely building a plant. And I think they'll do very well in Europe because the price of gasoline is much higher in
Europe.
And
it's, of course, higher because they don't subsidize the oil industry in
exactly
the way that the United States does.
Exactly.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudi, and we're speaking with Larry Schweiger. And he's the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance. Stay tuned. Let's go to some of these policies that you're hopeful about.
Yeah.
We've not seen very much movement so far, not with the international community and not here in the U.S., because as you mentioned, we've had a lot of representatives that don't understand the climate issue. What kind of movement have you seen that gives you some sense that there will be policies?
I'm hopeful that the American public is going to drive this change. I don't put a lot of hope in the politicians getting there on their own. They don't understand it because they don't want to understand it. You know, if you look at where the money's coming from for elections, the incumbent industries, coal, gas, oil, are pumping a lot of money into these elections. And others, like the Koch brothers, putting enormous amounts of money into elections. And they also put an enormous amount of money into our media. So they have a real lockhold on politics and on media. But I think eventually the American public's going to figure out that we have a very serious problem. And I think it's starting to show through in a pretty dramatic way. I've been seeing more and more indications that people are getting that our climate system is being disrupted. And when you look at what's happening to California, for example, and the impact that it has on the food supplies of the country, we're seeing the same thing in Arizona and New Mexico and parts of Texas. And we're seeing these huge forest fires and tremendous storm events, what happened in Colorado last year, what happened in New York City. People are starting to connect the dots. And at some point, there's going to be a moment when they do not tolerate politicians who are pretending that this is not a problem.
You know, one of the things that I watch is when politicians put forward policies that they think will be popular, but they don't really do very much. They're sort of symbolic. And that's one of the things I fear. Even if, say, the majority come on board to put forward a climate bill, what will it really contain in it that is meaningful?
It's an interesting point. The climate bill that we moved through the House at the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, frankly, was a bill that had issues, but it was actually going to cut carbon emissions over time by 80%. And we got that bill to the Senate and it stalled out, you know, Senator Ted Kennedy's death replaced by Senator Braun. We lost, you know, the majority that we needed in order to pass a bill in the Senate. And so that bill died. But I think it's going to come back. There's a growing need or feeling a need. Even the senators themselves did an overnight filibuster recently where they talked all night. They literally stayed up all night talking about climate change. It was symbolic, but it was an indication that they're starting to see the pressures mounting and they're willing to stand up and talk about it. And I think you're going to see that more and more. And I think, as I said earlier, these shifts occur very quickly. You know, one day, you know, you can get away with saying stupid things about climate change, and the next day it catches up to you. I see that coming. I have hope that that will happen.
You mentioned the media just now. You also talked about it quite a bit in your book and about really how superficial the United States media have been and in its own way misinforming people about the climate issue. You know, we get an IPCC report and then they cover it. Al Gore comes out with his movie and they cover it and people start to understand things, but then you have ClimateGate. ClimateGate happens and then everybody goes, oh, science, you know, science is all rigged. So I wonder, when we think about informing people, you think they're connecting the dots. How are they managing to do this?
My personal view is that it's more through the social networks. It's more through organizing it on campuses. It's more through.
So it's the younger people.
So it's younger people primarily, but we're also seeing increasing numbers of women starting to understand that their kids' future is at risk, the things that they really love and care for. And so I think there's a loving leadership that's emerging, and I think you'll see more and more women stepping up. I also believe that the politicians are really reflecting what's currently happening, and they don't have a real long field of vision. They look to the next election. And I think they're hoping that they get by on the next election by telling a false story about climate change. And I think a few important elections can turn that around, where people reject a lawmaker because he or she has been on the wrong side of climate change. And I think a few of those kind of turning points will wake the others up.
That'll be interesting to see. One of the things that you wrote about in the book was about how mass media have been really trivializing American life and American politics, and that has created more problems with people understanding the environment and what's really going on with the issues. What is going on behind the scenes of the media that you think is leading to this?
The media at one point in time was required to create content that met a test called the Fairness Doctrine. Today, they no longer are required to do that. So we've seen a a decline, I think a very rapid decline in the overall content on media. And a good example for me is what I witnessed in the Gulf oil spill. There were a number of camera crews down there interviewing BP employees and a few watermen who were not able to fish. And I went around and asked them if they were out on the water, had they actually seen the spill, even though they're only 8-10 miles from some of the oil. They hadn't seen it. And the reason for it was that their companies wouldn't hire the boats to go out onto the water. And so we hired the vessels to take them out onto the water and showed them the damage that was being done. Every day we took the various camera crews out. And so most of what people saw on television was shot off of boats that we had rented so that the media could see the event.
So had you not done that, you, the leader of a nonprofit organization, all that people would have gotten would have been interviews with BP.
Talking heads. And BP footage, which is the other thing that happens. You know, BP flies at 30,000 feet and flies over the spill and says everything's under control. And that's the image that they were striving to achieve. We were effective, and so effective that BP hired a new media firm to come in and actually then paid all the watermen 6 months in advance and gave them a contract that was double what we could pay them, plus they paid for their gasoline every day. So they basically bought the boats off the water, and that's why the media stopped covering the spill. The spill was still going on. We just couldn't access boats because they had been hired away by BP, and they were having the boat captains sit on the docks. They were paying them to sit on the docks.
A couple things I can draw from this. One is that journalists didn't have the company support to actually go do a good job.
Right.
But the other thing might have been even a little bit of, you know, it's too much trouble.
You know, the really sad thing today is we see it over and over again. Journalism is no longer what it once was. Before, you had crews that were out on the scene actually witnessing and recording, you know, what was taking place. Today, you're lucky to get talking heads, and it's the same talking heads, you know, every hour. It's the same people, and they are experts at all different things. They just hire them in to talk, and the people are not getting an unvarnished sense of what's happening in our world.
And certainly no context to help them understand how it's
Absolutely.
All put together. There was a bit of talk about carbon removal from the atmosphere. Do you think that's a viable option?
The best carbon removal system we have is trees.
Which are also dying.
Which are dying, but we need to be planting trees. We also need to be using winter cover crops on our soils. When the pioneers settled in the United States, they turned over soil and it was black. It was black because it was carbon. That was carbon in the soil. 50% of the organic matter is carbon. And what happened was they mismanaged the soil and burnt the carbon out of the soil. 20% of the carbon that we have in the air right now, the human-caused carbon, is from our soils. So as we grow cover crops and do other things, we can restore that carbon year by year, and we need to do that. So I think the best carbon capturing devices are actually trees and soils.
What about diet? Some people are saying that the meat industry generates 15-20% of the emissions as well.
What we ought to be looking at is these feedlots, these concentrated animal operations where animals are put into enclosed systems where the waste accumulates, vents a lot of methane, causes a lot of other water pollution problems. And we really ought to be looking at our food system.
So if you were going to advise everybody listening to us right now, top five things you could do to make a difference.
Well, I think the first thing to do is look at your own home. And there are a number of things that we can do. I encourage people to produce their own food. You know, that's a very low energy input for food. I have a garden at home that I use compost in, and it's an important part of how I live. Change out your light bulbs. Don't even stop at fluorescent. Go right to LEDs. You know, reduce your own carbon usage. If you can afford a new car, I would get either a hybrid or if you can afford it, get an electric car or take mass transportation, live in urban areas. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do in our own home. But I also think Americans need to take back America. You know, democracy does not function without the active participation of the voters. Ben Franklin, on his way out of the Independence Hall, was stopped, and a woman asked him, she said, "Sir, I understand you created a republic in there." And he said, yes, ma'am, we did, and it's yours if you can keep it.
Yes, I remember that.
And we're not keeping it very well. We're not doing our job. And so the fingers that we point at politicians, we ought to be pointing the other fingers back at ourselves. Yeah. We need to hold ourselves accountable as voters, to be informed, to understand what these people are doing. And it's very destructive. There's voter suppression going on now. There's a manipulation of voting districts so that people, you know, are basically carved out of the system. There's all sorts of things that are happening. We should demand that they change that behavior. And there are people who are clearly being oppressed by the bad politics that we're seeing.
And then finally, I wanted to ask you about something you wrote in your preface of your book, which is really essentially about how to live life and not taking on small battles.
Yes. My mentor is Ralph Auble, who was my Scout leader, and he was just a wonderful human being. But Ralph had landed on the beaches of Normandy, so he knew what a big battle was. He fought all the way through Europe and was a part of the liberation of one of the prison camps in Germany. But Ralph firmly believed that we should focus on the really big things and not get caught up in the details. And he used to say, Larry, don't fight any small battles because they don't inspire people. And, you know, I got involved in stopping acid rain in the 80s and 90s and now fighting the climate battle. You know, Ralph's been dead for 20 years, but I still hear his gravelly voice speaking to me, saying, don't give up this fight, to stay with it. And, you know, the persistence that he had during the Second War really inspired me. And so I see climate as one of those big fights that we must win. We hope we win. This is a must win for our children and for their children.
Well, thank you so much, Larry Schweiger.
Thank you.
The book is called Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. He is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for
being
with us.
It's great to be here.
When we come back, a refugee crisis of epic proportions. How has it come to this and what can be done? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. The refugee count has risen higher than any other time since 1994. 45.2 million people were displaced in 2012, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, and 7.6 million people were newly displaced that year. Of the displaced people, nearly 30 million were forced to flee but remain within their own countries, while another 15.5 million have sought refuge elsewhere. Each day in 2012, an average of 23,000 more people have been displaced. The greatest numbers were either in the Democratic Republic of Congo or in Syria. But why has the refugee crisis reached such proportions, and what can be done about it? We have with us three experts. Elizabeth Ferris is a senior fellow in foreign policy and the co-director of the Brookings Institute Project on Internal Displacement. She's the author of The Politics of Protection, The Limits of Humanitarian Action. Karen Musolo also joins us. Karen Musolo is professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law and founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She is co-author of Do They Hear When You Cry? And Refugee Law and Policy, A Comparative and International Approach. Gilbert Burnham is co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked extensively in emergency preparedness and response and humanitarian needs assessment with numerous humanitarian and health development programs throughout Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Elizabeth Ferris. You wrote in one of your pieces that World Refugee Day reminds us of our failures as an international community. Why do you say that?
Sure. Here we are still displacing millions of people, both internally within the borders of their country and as refugees. I mean, the numbers are just far too high for this day and age. I think we should be able to do better to prevent the violence and conflicts that is displacing so many people.
What is the scope of it? What are we facing in terms of numbers?
Well, if you look in terms of refugees, that is people who have crossed a border because of conflict, persecution, or massive violations of human rights, the number is about 15 million, of whom 5 million are Palestinian refugees, and the other 10 million are spread in 100 different countries around the world. But if you add to that those who are displaced within the borders of their country, also because of conflict, violence, or human rights violations, the numbers go way up. There are about 28 million displaced by conflict. And then when you add people who are displaced by natural disasters, at least sudden onset natural disasters, the figure climbs even higher. There are about 38 million who were displaced in the past year because of disasters.
Now, the United Nations has said this is actually the worst it's been in about two decades. Gilbert Burnham?
Yes, I think that we probably reached the previous high water mark with the genocide in Rwanda and the massive movement of populations into DR Congo and Tanzania. And then things settled down for a while, and I think with the continuing upheaval, particularly in the Middle East and with the unresolved situations with Iraqi refugees, with Afghan refugees, and now with the increasing numbers of Syrian refugees, I think we're going to see even a higher number reached in the near future. And to follow on what Elizabeth said, we have another classification that we're seeing very much in Syria right now, and those are the people who would like to be displaced if they could, but they're trapped because of conflict or trapped because of hostile forces on various sides, and they really can't get out. They can't get access to any type of services. They can't get access to humanitarian assistance that is available within Syria.
So then what distinguishes the internal displaced people from people who are under siege? Is it just that they're stuck in their home?
Well, the other thing that distinguishes them is that once that you're outside of the country, then the international humanitarian networks, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and others can provide protection and assistance. But inside the country, the displaced populations or the people who would like to flee really don't have much in the way of protection. And dealing with this population in Syria right now is an extremely difficult and fraught undertaking.
Just one more thing on Syria and Iraq. I understand from your writing, Gilbert Burnham, that you already had, I think it was 2 million or 3 million Iraqis that were in Syria as refugees, and then the Syrian crisis happened. Where do they go? What happens to them now?
Well, most of them are either en route back to Iraq or are in Iraq already, and this is producing quite a bit of strain on Iraq, and a large number have gone back to Basra. Some have gone back to the area around Baghdad, but Iraq still has 1.1 million internally displaced people from the conflict. This is a situation that's not resolving, and I don't think people expect it to resolve. So I think we're going to see a very substantial jump in the number of internally displaced people within the country.
And I'll want to go back to that a bit more, but let's bring Karen Musalo in now. What is it that you would add in terms of the scope and the driving forces of this problem?
Well, I think that my colleagues have really identified that, you know, refugees come into existence or internally displaced because of the failures, in a way, the tragic failures of the international community to help resolve the conflicts and the situations that give, you know, rise to this, you know, to the persecution, the risk that people are put at in conflicts. And so I think that too often refugees are seen as part of a quote-unquote immigration problem to deal with. And I think that it really behooves us to look more deeply and to say, you know, these are the victims of the failures of nation states and of the international community to stop conflict or to, you know, try to negotiate settlements or to somehow be a positive force. The refugees and the internally displaced are really you know, populations at great risk, and they call for a humanitarian response. And I think that all too often, many countries just want to, you know, pull up the gangplank and fortify their borders and keep people out. And that's really not the solution. The solution has to be to address the problems that cause people to flee. And I think that my two colleagues on the panel have really identified a number of very serious conflicts that are raging that are giving rise to this high mark of refugees and internally displaced people at this point in time.
Now, I understand also that there's the gendered component to the problem with both the refugees and the internally displaced people. Karen Musala, while I've got you talking now, why don't you tell us what you've seen in your research? I think all three of you have written about this from different aspects.
My focus, thank you. My focus has been quite a bit on how the international community interprets the refugee definition. The refugee definition came into existence in the aftermath of World War II, and I think it came into existence in a time period when there wasn't a full recognition of women's rights as being human rights, and there was really a male paradigm to who was a refugee. A refugee was somebody fleeing a violation of their civil or political rights. And as the women's rights rights activists really became a potent force and made the point that the violation of women's rights is a human rights violation, and practices that, you know, harms or forms of persecution that affect women, predominantly affect women or are unique to women, that they are deserving of being brought within the refugee definition and given protection. But that there's really been quite a bit of resistance, and my focus has been a lot on more the Western industrialized countries that receive refugees and adjudicate refugee claims and who they actually recognize within their judicial systems as refugees. And it has been a real struggle to obtain the recognition that women who are often, you know, the sort of range of things that happen to women during conflict and even in times of peace, so whether it's being raped, forcibly impregnated during conflict, taken as sexual slaves by warring forces, or in societies where they're subject to practices like forced marriage or female genital cutting or could be the victims of honor killing. So these are all the kinds of things that women may cross borders to try to escape to save their lives from. And a lot of resistance in recognizing these forms of harm as persecution within the meaning of the refugee definition. So I know there's a lot to say in the perspective probably that that Gilbert Burnham and Elizabeth Ferris can bring to this, looking at among the internally displaced and among refugees outside industrialized countries who are in camps or otherwise in precarious situations.
You've been prompted, Elizabeth Ferris. Let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you also see not only are women fleeing gender-based violence and horrific situations, but too often in the places where they're seeking protection, they find more violence and exploitation. I just came back from Jordan and Lebanon looking at the situation of Syrian refugees, where you see certain increases in domestic violence, for example, in camp settings. But most of the Syrian refugees are not living in camps. They're living in the community and largely invisible. And so we heard stories, for example, of a family renting, a Syrian family renting a house from a Lebanese landlord, and the Lebanese landlord saying, oh, you can't pay the rent. Well, how about if you give your 12-year-old daughter to my cousin as a bride? You know, this early marriage, for example, has become quite common. And if I could say something more about internal displacement, I think Gilbert is right that sometimes those who are displaced are not the most vulnerable. You know, sometimes it's people with disabilities or elderly or people who for one reason or another can't leave their homes as easily as those who are able to make it to another city or even to another country. And yet people who are displaced lose not only their shelter, but often they lose their social protection networks. You know, you move to a strange town and you don't know where is a safe road or where are the landmines or who do you trust or where can I get water. So I think there are particular vulnerabilities that come with displacement, but that people who are trapped, who can't get out, may in fact be even needier and harder to assist than those who have moved.
Gilbert Burnham.
Just to pick up on what Elizabeth said, we finished a study of elderly Syrian displaced populations in Lebanon, and the circumstances of many of these are really appalling, and I think that if we hadn't been out specifically looking for it, we would have missed this population completely. And these are people with a number of chronic diseases. These are people who've lost key members of their household, and there are people in Lebanon without any type of formal assistance programs. And the various groups that are there more or less stumble across these groups, many of whom don't want to be registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Office because they're afraid they can be traced back to having left the country if they wish to return in the future. And so they're in a very difficult situation. I think we're starting to appreciate this more than we did in the past. And one of the difficulties we've had with our refugee populations have been many of our policies, and especially true of the public health side of things, have been focused on the rural African peasant who moves across the border, reconstructs the house out of grass and sticks and mud. And now we're dealing with a largely urban population, more educated, more subject to non-communicable diseases, chronic diseases than we saw in the past. That's made a major shift. And now we're also in a situation where only a third of refugees, really as recognized refugees outside of their country, are living in refugee camps. And the rest of them, and I think as Elizabeth mentioned, are living in between the spaces and out of sight and difficult to reach. And this is becoming an increasing problem among Syrians in Turkey and creating a lot of tensions with the local populations. But then just to finish with something that Karen mentioned, and we've been looking at gender-based violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the eastern area, in the Kivu area. This is internally displaced people by the continuing internationalized local conflict there. And we're finding a number of men that have been subject to gender-based violence. And when we first noted this earlier with Sudanese refugees, we checked in with a number of groups that look at gender-based violence, and they said, well, we only do women, we don't do men. And we're finding this to be a very economically and socially devastating event that happens to males, many of whom are having a difficult time ever recovering from it.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about the magnitude of the refugee crisis, how we got here, and what we need to do now to resolve the problem. Stay tuned. What you're describing is pretty horrific. Does it seem like it's really getting worse in terms of the atrocities and the circumstances that people are facing that are victims of the conflicts? Or does it seem to be more of the same? Karen Musolo?
Well, I was thinking that one of the things I'd like to do is bring the issue into sort of the current debate we're having in the U.S. about comprehensive immigration reform. And one piece of it that's very relevant to refugees and victims of persecution is there's a clamor for stopping illegal immigration and fortifying our border. And really, the way in which many people fleeing persecution access protection is to illegally cross borders. I mean, we know, during the Holocaust that the people who we lionized as being heroes were the people who provided false documents to allow the Jews to flee the Holocaust. And it's not different in the sense that individuals who are fleeing persecution have to often cross borders illegally. And so when we in the U.S. talk about, making it more difficult to enter our country as same situation within the European Union, Australia, so many countries. So as the situation, I think, does worsen with these conflicts around the world and the human rights violations that accompany them, we are making it more difficult for people to flee and to seek protection. And, you know, I want to bring in the being in the U.S. and having some ability to perhaps influence, you know, or illuminate the issues that are being debated. We don't have a visa that somebody could apply to who wants to seek asylum in the U.S. The way that they seek protection in the U.S. is to make their way across the border. And we have so many deaths in the desert and along the border because we've made it so dangerous for people to cross borders. So many people who perish at sea, so people fleeing different countries from Africa who, you know, are trying to make it to Spain or Italy, who perish when their small craft capsizes, and Haitians who have tried to flee to the U.S. and the same. I want to agree with what Gilbert and Elizabeth have said about the dire nature of the situation, but also talk about the need that countries have to have a humanitarian response and to find ways to enable or facilitate the flight of individuals and their entry into countries where they can seek protection. And the U.S. is included in that calculus. I see the U.S. only making it more difficult and more dangerous for individuals to enter to seek protection.
Well, you beat me to the last question that I was going to go to, so let's just go there. But maybe on the way, Elizabeth Ferris, you've written about the politics of protection and specifically about why some groups get protection, but others that are equally needy do not. What do you find are the primary factors?
Well, and to pick up on what Karen was saying, I think we see a global trend of governments closing their borders through various means. I mean, usually they don't say the border is closed, but they can do like Turkey is doing now, managing migration, or have, you know, so many bureaucratic and visa requirements it's impossible for people who are genuinely fearful for their life to find protection in other countries. And I think that the more that developed industrialized countries do that, the more it gives permission to other countries in regions where there's large-scale conflict to do the same. But also, to go back to your question about are things worse now, I really don't know. I mean, you look at the Rwandan genocide or the neighbors killing neighbors in Bosnia. I mean, things were pretty horrific, back in the 1990s. I don't think there was ever a real golden age, if you were. What's different now, though, I think, is that we see it. I mean, there's thousands of hours of the Syrian conflict on YouTube and Twitter and people reporting from, you know, live ordinary citizens about their experiences. We no longer have that excuse of saying, oh, we didn't know this was happening. We didn't know how bad it was. And I remember in the early days of the Rwandan genocide, as news just kind of trickled out and find this horror of reading faxes and telexes, oh my gosh, can this really be going on, but not realizing the full import of it for days after the violence had broken out. And now it's happening in real time and on our TV screens, and it's there. And I think that's one of the reasons I feel this anger that we aren't doing better. We don't have that excuse now to say, oh, we didn't really know what was going on. So it may not be worse in quantitative terms, but I think it's worse in terms of the impact and the responsibility we should feel for these situations.
And in terms of the structure of protection or the politics of protection, which you have studied extensively, do you have a sense of why some people do get protected and others don't?
Well, I think here, if we look at the situation of internally displaced persons compared with refugees, our international system is built on sovereignty. It's the responsibility of national governments to protect and assist those who are displaced within their borders, even when sometimes it's that government that's responsible for the displacement. It's hard for international actors to intervene or to take actions to address both the causes or care for them. So there are differential standards right there. If you make it across the border, I mean, you have access usually to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a big, fairly effective international organization that protects and assists refugees. But if you stop short, you know, if you're 10 miles inside Syria, you don't have access to those systems of protection. And that's really a function of the international system that we live in, where, you know, governments are sovereign in their the actions they take within their own borders.
Gilbert Burnham, let's bring you back in now in terms of the structures that people can go to if there are enough. What needs to be changed that you see on the international level?
Well, I think there's several levels, and
one of them, we're seeing a constant shift in the type of refugees and their protection needs and their health needs and their educational needs. So we have to be keeping up with this trend. And one of the areas we've fallen really behind in has been how do we care for urban refugees? And this, as I said earlier, the system really is still focused on the rural peasants. And the Iraqi situation was a real wake-up call when vast amounts of money had to be spent in treatment of cardiac diseases and treatment of renal diseases and so forth. So it became a really expensive operation, and we started to see that this is a much different population than we've been set up to manage through the international structure. So one of the things is that we need to keep up with the changes in things. And I think from a more legal side of things, which I'm not really entitled to talk about, is the whole idea of protection and who constitutes persons of concern, persons of interest. And I think there is a recognition that we need to look at transcending the sovereignty issues at times. But the whole redefinition that Karen has done a lot with, that needs to be pushed forward much better. And then I think from our side in public health, what we're trying to do is to look at how do we measure situations more effectively, how do we get a better understanding of what's happening and in a dynamic sense. And as Elizabeth mentioned, we know a lot more about it. We understand probably less. Recent surveys both in the U.S. and in U.K. have shown that, you know, only perhaps 10 or 15% of the population really understands the magnitude of the loss of life among civilians in Iraq. So we've been exposed to it, but we can't handle the numbers. We're locked in denial. We have a lot of issues with that somehow we need to be better communicators about.
Well, Gilbert Burnham, a couple of things that you've written about that I just wanted to get your thoughts on now. One deals with the impact of food prices, and the other is just trying to get people into employment and getting a place to live. How is that occurring now? You're talking about how much it's changing and how much needs to be done. And do we have the resources to be able to do this with this massive amount of people in trouble?
Well, I think there are a number of issues that we can see played out right now in Lebanon, for example. And the influx of Syrians there has driven up the price of housing. It has driven up the access to food. Lebanon is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. It has no formal structure to provide assistance. People are living in makeshift camps, in unfinished construction, and so on. So they're having a really difficult time. Do we have the resources? I think we have the resources. But I think coming back to something Elizabeth said earlier, sometimes humanitarian assistance has been characterized as the humanitarian fig leaf that really covers our shame because we've not been able to take the decisive political actions. We don't have the will to be able to head off some of these events before they really fester and they really become something that is really a stretch to manage.
Karen Musilo, let's bring you back in because Gilbert Burnham started to talk about the international legal system. How do you see it?
Well, I think there's probably two pieces, and they're very obvious ones. I mean, they're obvious, but they're very intractable and difficult to address. But one is that we really need to allow better ability for people fleeing persecution to access territories of protection. And that's a large issue because, as Elizabeth said, this concept of sovereignty and about crossing borders and every country having the right to determine who can enter their country and under what circumstances. But there are international norms and the, you know, the right to seek asylum and the norm of non-refoulement to not return a person to a country of persecution. So number one, I think we need as an international community to come up with a better way to allow the movement of people fleeing persecution to leave their country and to enter other countries. And we need to really shame those countries that engage in refoulement, that engage in the return of people to situations of persecution. It simply is not, should not be accepted to return people to their death and their torture. And number two, that's sort of a procedural issue in a way. And number two, on a substantive level, it's the definition of who should come within the definition of a refugee, who deserves protection. And again, to bring it back to the U.S. borders, you know, we see now the skyrocketing numbers of unaccompanied children from Central America trying to enter the U.S. because of intolerable levels of all forms of abuse, of organized crime and gangs preying upon children. And I think that the definition of a refugee needs to evolve with the societal and political and historical realities of our world. And to send a 12-year-old back, you know, there's documented case of a young Honduran who was fleeing a gang. He told an immigration judge that if he was sent back to Honduras, it was either Honduras or Guatemala, so I apologize for not remembering which of those two countries, he said that he would be killed. And within several months of being returned, he was, in fact, shot to death, a young teenage kid. So, I mean, we need to look at who we bring within the refugee definition, not strain it so far that people feel that it doesn't have viability as a concept, but we need to look at who really is at risk of serious and grave violations of their human rights, and as an international community, we need to find room to bring them within the refugee definition and to protect them.
Elizabeth Ferris.
Yes, I definitely agree. I mean, the gang violence, the criminal elements are also linked to what Gilbert was talking about, this new phenomena of urban refugees or urban displacement. When people flee violence for the cities, you know, cities are often violent places, and they may get caught up in a violence that they thought they were trying to escape. And you know, provision of humanitarian assistance is much more complicated in a city when you've got lots of different actors, and the best way of helping refugees and IDPs may in fact be to support local government health programs or local municipal authorities.
I think that's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you. We really appreciate you coming on with us and sharing your research with us and our listeners, Elizabeth Ferris, Karen Musolo, and Gilbert Burnham. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Ferris is a senior fellow in foreign policy and the co-director of the Brookings Institute Project on Internal Displacement. She's the author of The Politics of Protection, The Limits of Humanitarian Action. Karen Musolo is professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law and founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She is co-author of Do They Hear When You Cry? And Refugee Law and Policy, A Comparative and International Approach. Gilbert Burnham is co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked extensively in emergency preparedness and response and humanitarian needs assessment with numerous humanitarian and health development programs throughout Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Leonardo Alanis. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at Armudian.